Hello and welcome to episode 114 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Oh, hello, Matt. We're back again, and it's great to see you. You're looking well rested after the weekend.
Yes, it's going to be interesting because we're recording in the morning, which we don't usually do because of pressing other appointments and stuff. So it'll be interesting to see whether you can tell a difference. Are we more sprightly and energised, or are we less drunk?
I've often said I'm far more useful in the morning than I'm in the evening. This is a much better. You've got 100% Western tonight.
Well, or this morning, yeah.
You see, I'm used to recording at night. There's a contextual issue here.
Well, there is, but then of course when it's being listened to, there's also a contextual issue, which means that you should avoid making any reference whatsoever to any sort of time frame, because you never know when somebody's going to be consuming the content.
Yeah, that's true. They could be having a great afternoon.
And that's before we even start to get into time zones.
So anyway, what have we got, Matt?
So what we got this week, we have got an interview with a chap called Jeremy Hollow, who I've known for quite some years actually now, and runs a social listening research company called Listen and Learn, which it's qualitative research from social networks, which they do for brands and other stuff. So I had a good chat with him a few weeks ago, which we're going to play that out. And we also have an internet yin and yang, because it's that sort of week. So I think, given the pressures of time, we should just blooming well get on with it.
So let's do the yin and the yang then, Matt. We had one last week, didn't we? Or certainly the week before. We've come back to the yin and yangs a little bit. And this week I would like to present my yang of the internet, which is a video that I was referred to. Now, we shared about, I don't know, I guess it must be a year ago, a Boston Dynamics video where they had their Atlas robot doing various tasks and being knocked about by a hockey stick, etc. And this is kind of a follow-up to that. And it shows an Atlas-style robot going through even more complex tasks, catching things and getting knocked around by hockey sticks. And I just think it's one of those things that, as you watch it, it starts out and it looks fairly authentic, and then as you go on, you start to wonder, can this really be real? And I don't know. I think people should just watch it and see what they think. We'll share the link.
Yeah, we'll share a link to it. I have to say, the actual Boston Dynamics ones, they are, I think, questionable in terms of their authenticity, because what they don't show is the person who's controlling it.
And also, there's lots of cutting room floor stuff, isn't there?
Almost certainly. But I mean, it's very impressive what you can get a humanoid or dog-like, what do you call that, a canoid, robots do these days. But it comes back to that thing about the way in which we perceive more intelligence in things that look like us, because we're quite diminutive creatures, quite frankly. Yeah. So anyway, we'll stick a link to that on the website, wb40podcast.com. Worth a look.
So what's your yin this week, Matt?
Well, it's of my access to the internet and discovering through practical steps what happens when an iPad Pro meets most part of a cup of coffee. And it's not good.
What sort of coffee was it, Matt?
It was a Americano with milk, brewed with my own coffee machine here. I'd put it in one of those thermos cup things, and I'd put it in my bag, and it fell over, and I'd not press the button to seal the cup.
So it wasn't. It was not an immersion as much as it was knocking it over the.
Yeah. Yes. So I mean, the things that we learned from that. First of all, that my iPad now smells of coffee, which is quite nice. We learned that for the first 24 hours, the iPad thought that the headphone socket was full of a headphone. Rather than being full of coffee, but that seems to have sorted itself out now. So sound is back on, which is good. We've also, I think, though, discovered the strong capillary action that is available from an iPad Pro LED screen, because the one thing that doesn't seem to be resolved has been the screen. I've now got very uneven brightness across the said device, and that's It's annoying, quite frankly.
Can't you take it,
can't you take it to a genius
or something? Isn't that how those things work?
The thing is, and this, I guess, is my moan about all of this, because my iPad actually has become a very central part of my day-to-day working life. And, of course, to now replace it, I could go second-hand, but I'd worry about buying a second-hand device because you're kind of already into the stuff starting to fail. Or I could buy a new one, except, of course, the new ones are much more expensive than the last ones, and I'd have to replace the pencil and replace the keyboard, both of which are perfectly fine, if slightly, you know, coffee-flavoured.
Why do you have to replace the pencil? Because
they're all changed, you see. Every time they do a new iteration. So the pencil, the keyboard alone for an iPad Pro is £179. The pencil is about, I think it's 130. The last one was 100. And they are really useful tools, and I use them a lot, and I struggle to not have them. But the obsolescence that is built into these devices, and the complete lack of serviceability that's built into these devices.
Says the man that keeps buying them.
Well, I don't.
You're encouraging this behaviour.
That's unfair. I don't. And this is the thing, that I'd love to be able to just say, oh, go and get a new screen in it. But the thing, I might check with Apple to see what a new screen would cost. But the ability to be able to take the devices apart is the problem, because they've built them to be really not serviceable by anybody, let alone by users. And that's an issue.
Surely you can get a refurb one or something. Yeah, there are ways around this.
But that's, I don't know. So anyway, don't pour coffee on iPads is the general advice out of this little experiment.
When my first computer ever, when I was a little smidgen of a Chris Weston.
A West Ed?
Yeah, I was. It was a Dragon 32, right?
Oh, and Welsh and proud.
Yeah, Welsh and proud. Poor Talbot. And I, the manual said, keep, don't port stuff down the back of your Dragon 32, because, and it said the computer doesn't work on as well on tea and coffee as you do. And I remember that in the manual. And do you know what? It's refreshing to know that today, in these, in this new atomic age, that these things are still those fundamentals hold true.
No, I know. I mean, the thing is that they could be. Seeing as they don't allow you to plug anything in, like, SD cards or anything like that, they could as well be, was it IP rated? But they don't, because, Anyway, so don't pour coffee down your iPad. Certainly don't throw it over robots. I think that's some useful life lessons from this week's Yin and Yang.
Lots of value from everybody there. So as we mentioned earlier, we've got an interview with Jeremy Hollow. Who's, what did you say Jeremy's company was, Matt?
Listen and Learn Research.
Listen and Learn Research. And Matt and Jeremy and his business, they do a lot of work in social media, don't they? And gathering opinions and getting wisdom of the crowd from social media. Is that true?
That's right. And so when I spoke to him, I asked him, first of all, exactly a bit more about what it was that the company did.
Our mission is pretty simple. We try to use social data to help brands become something that people will actually care about. So in that terms, it means kind of having a messaging and a purpose that resonates with an audience. It means creating products that fill a need and that people get excited about and want to have as part of their lives. Or it's about creating customer experiences that people genuinely enjoy and create and feel that they create value for them over and above the things that everyone else does. And it's really about how social data, i.e. the things that we share on social, be that comments or whether that's pictures or videos or whatever, actually is a reflection of how we feel about life, how we interact with each other in a more natural, more immediate way than sort of traditional market research channels.
So for some people, this might be getting them thinking about things like sentiment analysis, which is automated, generally automated mechanisms to be able to get whether people are happy or sad about things. But that's not quite what you're doing, is it?
No, I suppose we approach it from, if we had to come down on the qual or the quant line, we are an agency of qualies. And our approach is to really read, absorb, reflect, think about the meaning that people are expressing in the things that they say to each other and they share to each other. Maybe that's looking at a picture and trying to find out or think about the different way that that picture is being composed and what someone's trying to show by doing that. Or it's about reading what they've written to each other and really pulling apart all the different things, all the factors or the attributes or the different bits of meaning that they're trying to share and the way that they're trying to explain how they feel to other people. Our job is to understand all of those signals, to pull apart all of that social content in a reflective kind of way, understand all of those factors at a deeper level, and then build and bring them back together to build a story that helps our clients understand people in a different way. So it is a qualitative approach, it is reflective, it's thoughtful. Our background is in that kind of work. So it does mix a bit of quant analysis, but it's qualitative, it's psychology, it's brand, it's marketing, it's comms. Those are the kind of disciplines that we bring to the understanding and interpretation of social data, which I think is in a bit of a contrast to how it's most the other way, which is to use a social listening platform to interpret and create dashboards and metrics. I think one is very much an information level or an intelligence level where you have metrics such as sentiment, which are produced automatically using certain systems. The other one is more reflective and about building something that's more than the sum of the parts to help you understand life in a different way.
So the volume of information and data that's being generated on social networks is often described as being like a fire hose, in that kind of just this overwhelming volume of stuff. If you're taking a very person, people and quality approach to thinking about how you interpret that, how do you go from this, you know, mass of stuff to being able to gain insight that people are identifying?
I think that's a great question. I think that's where our kind of research backgrounds come from. So we are not technologists, so it's not an API-driven approach. It's more of a research-led approach to interpreting this meaning and finding value in this data. And of course, we work with those systems. So we work with social listening providers to get access to these different fire hoses of data. And those are the best way of collecting it, getting hold of it, getting it in a manageable way. Otherwise, it's an impossible task to try to do it all manually. I suppose where our approach then is to think about, and then working with our clients to understand how they're making decisions, what the level of data is that they need to do. So you can do what you do in normal market research, which is to build a sample approach of sampling data that matches and is proportionate to the kind of scope of the challenge that you're looking to address and to answer. Then you just choose the data that works with that. You pick random samples, you clean the data, you make sure you're working with the best quality data possible. And then that's how you do it. It's very similar to how you would sample the general population for normal market research. But typically we would work in thousands. So you're working with quite large data sets. So you're seeing a depth and a breadth of opinion across both sources. So it's not just from Twitter, for example, it's across other forms of publicly available social data. And you're also looking at a breadth of experience. So you're looking at lots of people. And we usually find that when you sit down and talk to people who are going to be making decisions off the back of it, if we've got findings that are based on a random sample of several thousand people, that's usually good enough. It's a practical way of picking a broad spectrum of opinion to work from and then dealing with it in a sort of robust and considered way.
Interesting, you come from a research background. Does your heart sink with lots of the research that you see going around on the internet these days?
It all depends where it is. I always like the World Economic Forum videos that they put out with their stats. That's all good. There's good research and there's bad research. I think it all depends where you're heading from it. I think from our point of view, the role that research and insight professionals have is to ask questions about the value of the data. And that's really an important role. We've all been in meetings where someone bright is picking apart your numbers. And you learn that it's really important to understand where it all comes from. And that's a discipline that's missing from this kind of like adoration of big data at the moment. Because there's so much rubbish that comes out from social. And by that, I mean, it's duplicates. It's fake stuff. It's just basically rubbish. It's the way that it collects the data is based on keywords. And you're never going to be good enough to get a query that's going to give you the data that's 100% relevant. And there is just so much irrelevancy, rubbish, nonsense within that data But unless you actually spend time looking at it, you won't realize how wrong it is. So you may get your stats from your social listening provider, which is giving you sentiment levels of this and this, or reach levels of this. But unless you actually spend time reading and thinking and actually interrogating that data with a sort of slightly cynical hat on, you're never going to know how robust that data is. It's not in the listening provider's interest to tell you. They're not set up to do that. Their job is to get as much data in as possible, put it in a dashboard, make it look pretty, and sort of wrap that up as an insight package. The role of research here is to, one, really focus on the question that you need to ask of the data, the challenge that you have, the solution that you need to change your business. Then think about whether the data you're working with is the right data to meet that challenge. Then it's the process of how you collect and extract data and create meaning from that data. And then it's the storytelling. It's a debrief. It's how you then help bring that alive to the client organization so they then can then get inspired and energized to do something differently about it based on rigorous exercise that creates evidence that speaks back to that question.
So what are the sorts of questions that your clients are asking you to help them get insight on?
I think that it's just really quite a broad range. So we tend to work with people who, or agencies or clients that have a large sort of consumer base. And we tend to think of our work as one of three broad areas. The first one is really sort of those big strategic questions, like what should we be doing in this market? And that could be, we're thinking about, so we work a lot in sort of the sort of smart tech world. And one of the questions that we help one of our clients with is, we want to enter this particular product category. We believe it's a good adjacency for where we currently are. We don't have an offer in it. We're working with an OEM partner to develop our solutions for this category. What do we need to be successful in that market? And here we'll be looking at review data. We'll be looking at social data across multiple different markets and across multiple different brands. And then we'll be boiling down the experiences of thousands of different users who are already talking about the products that are in market in these categories at the moment, finding out what works for them, finding out what doesn't, finding where the unmet needs and the frustrations are, seeing which brands are performing most strongly and why. So that's that kind of strategic picture about where do we go. There's other work that we do, which is more around innovation. So looking at the flow of ideas through markets. So this can be to help people think about what spaces to go into, or actually who's influencing a particular market. And this isn't in, we're not an influencer marketing firm, but it's actually understanding how different people and different personalities are influencing the mass market to make the decisions that they have. Other areas that we would work in would be, for example, how to help a brand think about how to be interesting and engaging to a particular audience. So we've done this a number of times. It's really around the hearts and minds piece, where you trying to say, okay, we want to extend the reach of our particular product or our service or the experiences that we offer as a brand to a different audience. They're not engaged with us. They're not aware of us. They don't know anything about us. Our role in that situation is to say, okay, right, here's what's important to these people in these markets. So, for example, you know, some work we did for a pharmaceutical company, it was understanding what the market for what people with diabetes talk about online, what their needs are, what their experience of living with diabetes are. So that we then go back to the brand and the comms and the brand team within the company that we're working for, and help them understand what the needs were, what the lifestyle is really like to have diabetes, importantly, where those people are engaged online and how they're engaged online. It's really, there's a whole sort of dinner party of diabetes happening online. Our job is to make sure that when our client invited themselves to their dinner party, that they didn't just turn up like a buffoon bumbling around not knowing what to say. It was much more that they would go, be able to listen, be able to join that conversation in the right way, understand, be empathetic to the needs of that audience. And then once they'd built that credibility, then to start talking about some of the things that they wanted to talk about.
So sort of the sort of thing that maybe also techniques like focus groups would be, or would have been used for?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's one way of thinking, it is heart what we do is called research. It's just done on a large scale. And I think research is at a really interesting period at the moment. So we're coming out of a period where the only way that you could find insights about your customers was to ask them questions. And you do that through traditional quant or qual market research. And we're in a way now that, if you think about it, that's a very controlling way of getting insights and getting information from people. You set the questions. You usually give them a range of answers to go with. You provide all the seminars. It's quite a controlled environment, and you're asking people to deliberate on something that you've asked them to do. And we're sort of at a completely crossroads now, where lots of data sets are coming online: transactional, social, trend, our search behavior. All of these data sources are much more observational. So the researcher has had no role in creating that data. It's completely divorced. And so our job then is to look at that, the nature of that data. And where you say you've had your traditional focus group, that's great, but it's deliberated as a group on some things, and it's limited in size, and it's limited in those people who have time to do focus groups. What we're picking up is a much broader spectrum of opinion, which has not been directed at us. It's not a conversation we're part of. It's just something that we're able to observe through social data. And it's lots of different, thousands of different opinions about the same thing. And we're not really interested in the life of a person. It's not what we're about. We're interested in the experience of a condition, or the experience of an idea, or the interaction with a brand, or the experience of a service on large scale. And then from that, being able to interpret what's right and what's wrong and what's working. So we've got less groupthink going on. And the data is lovely. When you spend time reading lots of social comments about a particular topic, it can be incredibly moving, it can be incredibly banal, it can be nasty, it can be encouraging. There's all sorts of parts of humanity that come through that. And I think that's the difference between what you can get from this approach rather than, say, a traditional focus group. It's broader. The quality of the data, the nature of the data is very different because it hasn't been created as part of this research experiment.
Do you think that there is a risk with that, though? The thing about focus groups, obviously, because it's so framed, you can frame it to get the answer that you're looking for, and then that turns out to be wrong. And there's many, many cases of where that kind of approach has ended in that outcome. With these social channels, obviously, you're not framing the conversation, but there is an extent, surely, to which there's self-selection by people who are vocal on social media. And are there potentially biases with that we are unwittingly then drawing conclusions about the whole of the population?
Yeah, definitely. There is no perfect answer, but we have to remember that not everyone chooses to take part in market research. So it's all a question of how good is this data? Is there a better source of getting to the truth that we need to help move our business forward? And we can't get that much further. We have to participate. We have to find a way of observing behavior, but then knowing where that comes from. So most market research participants in traditional market research are paid for their time. So it's a very, that is, again, is a small audience who have the time and have the willingness to take part in that kind of work. So wherever we get data, it all is biased in a certain degree. I think our approach is by having a very wide sample of experience, it sort of cuts across some of that. And not everyone takes part in social. It's something for people, mostly frustrated authors. But what we find is it does skew, and certain populations skew towards certain social media sites. But that is also quite interesting. So if you're a brand and you're trying to get involved within a particular conversation, actually the location helps you find your tribe. It helps you find those people that are naturally engaged in the conversation that you want to have. So the skew in the sample is actually an interesting finding in itself.
I know, that makes sense. And of course, the point about people who contribute into conversation online, of course, is it's just a subset of the people who are involved in the conversation, and there's very little that can be done to be able to understand who listens. And that is something that often gets, I mean, particularly with internal social network, you know, enterprise social network things, this idea that it's only the people who are visible and vocal who are important misses the point that there are lots of people who are actually learning much from what they are consuming, but just don't contribute because they're that sort of person.
There's an interesting conversation at the moment about influencer marketing. So Mark Ritson's written some good articles about it, which is great. And I think it's absolutely right to call out dodgy followers and to get to the bottom of the math behind return on investment. But we don't want to lose everything else with that. And an anecdote of one is, I often watch friends of mine, they'll scroll. So influencers have become the Sunday Times style guide. They don't get rid of that. but when they're looking for stuff, you haven't got time to spend hours researching handbags or researching jeans. You see something from someone you trust, a shortcut that works for you, and then that helps influence your consideration choice. So it, influence does work, and it's not, the model isn't new. All right, it needs to be unpacked and it needs to be run and the numbers need to be assessed properly, but it clearly does work for a lot of businesses, and it's very interesting to see how that has changed this kind of passive, non-contributory kind of way of influencing people's purchasing patterns. And lots of people, and there's a thing, I suppose there's a big difference between traditional market research data and social data, in that market research transcripts, their verbatims, all the responses are held by the research agency or the brand. They're not out there for everyone else to see, where everything that Penman says on social is out there for anyone else to find. So one, it's a reflection of how people have experienced the brand or the things that are happening to them in life or how they feel about a particular topic. But it's also what Google shows us when other people then go to find out about that topic. So it's a reflection on life, but it's also a way of seeing what someone's digital discovery journey might be. When you sit down and Google, you start thinking about researching something new, and Google takes you on this path through the internet and social.
So mechanically, how do you go about doing this? Presumably there is technology involved, but you've also got quite a lot of people involved in the process.
Yeah, so it is, there's definitely a human element to it. So it starts with a question from whoever it is we're working with. We'll work with them to make sure that the scope's right and scale's right. Then there's this data collection layer. So we use a social listening provider, or we'll find alternative ways of collecting that data, all publicly available social data. Then the next stage is really to think about, how do we unpack everything that we start to read? And this is where the process and the workflow that we design sort of starts to come in. And it's really around, you read a sample of the comments, or you look at a bunch of pictures, and you start making mental models of the things that people are saying, how they're talking about it. So we think about, it's a form of analysis where you look at the words that people use, the choice of words, the choice of language, the choice of imagery, the choice of metaphor, the choice of picture, how they compose things. And you break all of those signals into different attributes that describe an experience. So I think an easy way to describe this is, you stay at a hotel, you walk in the front door, you've parked your car, you've got there, you meet someone takes your bag, you have to check in, you go in. All of these things are discernible attributes that can be used to describe your experience and breaking your experience of going to a hotel down. Some of them are very practical. So you knew where to go, the cost was right, all of those kind of things. You met someone, you got the key at the right time. It's kind of like really tangible stuff. Then there's a bunch of sort of more emotional features that go around that. So how do they make you feel? How did you feel when you got there? What are your expectations? What was your purpose of your stay? Why are you involved with it? And then there can be more sort of like esoteric, more metaphorical language that we can pick up as well. So what's the role of this experience in other things that are happening in your life? What kind of language do you use to describe how you felt and what's happening to you? And so all of these things that people say are signals that we can pick up and quantify. And what we're trying to do is build a big analysis framework which has lots of characteristics and lots of attributes that we can then use to structure what is inherently unstructured data. So you've got all of these comments, where without this approach, what you have is kind of like a mechanistic way of trying to just counting word frequency. So you'll be familiar with word clouds, but that can be helpful if it's very obvious, but there's no depth to it and there's no connection. What we do is, by identifying all the ways that people express themselves to other people in their comments, to build this framework which really explains everything that could be possibly happening within the thing that we're looking at. So if it's telling stories about your fund giving page and how you're communicating this desire to get people to sponsor you, we know we can unpack all of that kind of thing. And so we can, by that, we build this big kind of framework of variables. It's usually somewhere between 50 to 100 to 150 different variables that describe the experience that people are talking about. Once we've got that, we then have a team of people that work in English and across a bunch of different languages globally to read social data and then to use our framework to help us structure it and put some quantification behind it. So for example, if a bunch of people were talking about the check-in experience, we'll know exactly how many people there were. what we can then do once we've applied that framework is then look for patterns and look for differences and frequencies and the relationships between those kind of variables that we're finding. So what we'll always do is look for patterns. So if you're, which parts of the customer experience were the busiest or the most talked about? Oh, it was these three. Okay, right, let's break those down by the emotions that people felt at each of those stages. Okay, right, so we've got 90% of people were ecstatic and 10% of people were pissed off. Okay, let's look at the pissed off people and see what were they annoyed about. So what we're trying to do is take something that has no structure, give it a structure that comes from the data itself. It's not something we're imposing on it. We're seeing the patterns that people talk about. We're building that into a framework. We're then using that framework to structure all of those comments, all the images. Once we've got all that, it's quant analysis. It's looking at frequencies. It's looking at patterns. And then the next thing that we do is then reread the data with very specific purposes in mind. So it could be we're doing some work for a government agency at the moment who's interested in roads. Part of that analysis is to say, okay, when we look at a particular part of the road network, what is it that's driving satisfaction, or what is it that's creating frustration with people, and what's the very nature of that specific thing? So we're quantifying patterns in the data, saying what's happening, where's it happening. Then we're reading it again to really understand why it's happening. And then the next process is to sort of bring those two things together, to synthesize it, to tell the story, and to help answer the question that we started with. And that could be around, how do you appeal to, who are your audiences? What is it they need? What's missing? What's driving their interest? What role could you play in their life? And how would you go about delivering that? So that's kind of how the flow would work. So it's a mix of technology platforms to collect the data. It's a mix then, it's a blend of sort of qualitative research techniques to understand the meaning, bit of quant in there to put some numbers in, a bit more qual to understand the why. And it's the why that really activates things. And I think what we get when we deliver is, one, it's so much more detailed than people were expecting. There's so much more richness that comes through from the conversation, but it's also very tangible. So we can go back to people, you don't have to wonder. It's not an average score that you're trying to work out what could that mean. It's counting how many people have had that particular experience, which then becomes very powerful when you think about, if we have X percentages of people who have felt our staff were incompetent, I know exactly what the drivers of that incompetency were, which then makes it a very easy conversation to have with training and HR about what's the service standard that we have. This is where we currently have some opportunities to develop, and here are the specific behaviours that need to be worked on.
How often are clients actually surprised by what comes back?
It feels quite often, in a number of ways. One, because what we're doing is relatively new. So we've gone through this, as every entrepreneur has. You have a lovely journey where you have an idea, then you go through that process of realizing that it's not a new idea at all, and everyone else has had similar ideas at all, and then you sort of get to this point where you get the thing that you can do. And we've been doing that for a while, and a lot of what we're doing is trying to say to people, this is the potential in this data to do something interesting. A lot of those businesses have already got social listening partners in, and then when we get in there, that then becomes interesting. So when we deliver back to those organizations, it's like, okay, you can do a lot more than the dashboards, and that's really groovy. Or the other side, it's you get people, if you haven't spent any time really reading social data around the topic, you tend to think that it's okay to deal with a dashboard. And I can see when clients have actually spent some time reading it, because they've become to appreciate the data a lot more. They see the value in it a lot more. And that's when the surprise comes in. And there's some amazing things that we can do with the data in terms of mapping how people project things. So when we did a bit of work recently around the visual identity of two chocolate brands in Germany as expressed by their Instagram followers. And one brand was very obvious, very alpine. It was very dominated by the popular brand assets. The other brand had a completely different visual identity. And this is not the brand's identity. This is the identity that its customers portray on its behalf. And it was very, very striking to see how the two different brands came across. And the client found that very surprising, because it really helped crystallize how these two brands were being perceived by people.
So there's a lot of technology emerging at the moment that looks at things like natural language processing and the ability to use artificial intelligence to interpret stuff that previously was kind of untouchable by computing. How do you see that impacting in the areas in which you're working over the next few years?
I think it's, so there's two answers to this. There's the positive answer, which I think is great. I think it's really encouraging. I think it's amazing. So the promise is to be able to do what we can do on such a larger scale that you can be so much more confident with it. There's the more honest answer, which is, oh, blimey, my business is going to disappear. And then there's the pragmatic in between the two. So I think the promise is amazing. Do I see us doing all the manual coding work that we do at the moment on the interpretive layer in 5 years' time? I hope not. It would be great if we could find automatic tools that can really reliably do some of that legwork for us at the beginning, so we can spend more time interpreting the data and finding out answers and doing better things and more analysis of what we're getting out of it. At the moment, I think there are some great signs. I think there's some good signals. My experience with this at the moment is not the most positive. We're always looking out for technology providers. I think the natural language processing works really well when it's all based on, from my understanding of working out the algorithms and working out a taxonomy for understanding what kind of conversations are going to come through to a particular response. And so when I've seen it work, it's when it's in a survey context. So the question is known, and then the answers tend to be quite well predictable. So you've got a limited range of conversational options that are likely to come out. Then it's a case of machine learning about which words mean which thing. It's building that specific taxonomy. So this response means this thing. And that's kind of where I think we are at the moment in terms of the leaves. I don't know, Watson, I'm sure it can do some great stuff, but whenever we send our data to providers to have a look at it, it tends to go quite quiet and we don't hear very much back. And part of the problem is that social data, when you're looking, say, at brand response or you're looking at a category or looking at an issue like cancer or whatever it might be, the data is so varied. People can talk about so many different things that actually the machine really struggles to find any patterns that it knows, and requires so much work that it's just not a viable commercial option for us at the moment to replicate. It just don't, you can't replicate what we do quickly enough or cost effectively enough for it to be a viable option. I think the future is amazing in terms of what it could be doing, but I think there's loads of development that needs to happen in terms of making it robust and making it clear and making the black blocks argument here is frustrating. So a lot of the conversations we have with tech providers tend to end when we look to see examples, because we do what they do. We do a lot of the coding manually, i.e. this sentence means these things. So we can test it really easily, and it tends to break down a little bit then. And so that makes me think that it's perhaps not as robust as it might be, because things should be open for scrutiny, and they should be open for discussion about whether it's doing what it says that it's doing. That said, I think there's also a number of other layers which are interesting. Obviously, you get the privacy concerns from the different providers, which change the nature of the social data landscape. You get the ability to capture and process data in better ways. So imagery is great. The tools that deal with imagery are sort of a bit blunt. So it'd be great to capture more of that. Great to get more video content in. All of this stuff, it'd be good to see technology advance in terms of how we collect and harness the data and make it manageable in the research process by understanding its pedigree, understanding its provenance, where it's come from, its qualities, and the practicalities of just getting it and dealing with it. Then I think it's the automated analysis, which has a good promise, but has a lot still there to deliver.
Well, thank you to Jeremy for that, because that was an exploration around a lot of those issues that we still see in data and our ability to drive useful and valuable insight from it, which is around things like bias and who you're getting your data from. And what was the question you asked at one point? You talked about, oh, that's right, you mentioned the fact that, yes, in social conversations, there are lots of interesting things going on and people sharing opinions, but probably that's only 10 to 15% of the people involved, if you like, in that conversation. There's a lot of people listening and waiting for maybe a moment to provide some input, but often they never do. There's a lot of lurkers in relation to the noisy people in that sense.
Yeah, I think it's... social networks give a remarkable volume of data to social scientists to be able to look at stuff that they've never really had before. But it's like any source of data, it has its value. It also has large amounts of stuff that it doesn't cover because of the, you know, the nature of how it's constructed. And there's, I think there's two things out of that conversation with Jeremy that I find interesting. The first is that the extent to which we are able to use these sources of data as valuable data, and where they're useful and where they're not. And then the other side of it is the extent to which analysis of qualitative information involves us humans being involved and just immersing ourselves in this data, that insight can be driven through mathematical analysis of stuff, but equally it can be driven through qualitative immersion. And as we look at what's happening with the stuff that's bracketed as artificial intelligence at the moment, the things I find interesting about this are the extent to which an awful lot of them just reduce the qualitative to quantitative. And that's not the same. I remember when I was doing my degree many years ago, and there was a whole thing called content analysis, which was supposedly a qualitative technique for being able to do analysis of qualitative data. But all that happened was you basically counted up the words. It was all about reducing the richness of qualitative information down to numbers. And I mean, maybe I'm a Luddite, and maybe I'm, I don't know, maybe there's a bias I have, but I struggle to see how any of the technologies that we're working with at the moment have the ability to gain insight in the way in which a human can by immersing themselves in data.
Yeah, that's very true. Data. In fact, I was, something triggered a thought in my mind this morning as I was pottering about. There was a, whether it was a conversation on the radio or whether it was an article I'd been reading, and it made me think of people who are, you know, people who are very good at magic and conjurers and the people now who will, the David Blaine types or whatever that other person's called, robot or project or whatever his name is. What's his name?
Oh, his name's Steve, probably.
It's like one word, and it's whatever these people are, and they will influence you in order to in order to make you believe they've done some sort of clever trick. But what they really do is they have studied and understand how people react and when they can be distracted, etc., etc. And that's the kind of insight that you really are, we're kind of hoping for and expecting from our computers now, that we can understand how people react and what they're going to do next, and that we can predict the future in that sense, which of course we can't. It's just nonsense. It's all where it's shown to be done, a little bit like we talked about the videos, where it's shown to be done, there's a lot of hard work going into it, but it's a point in time. And we've got to the point where we have, a lot of people have swallowed the hype around artificial intelligence, machine learning, where you put lots of information in and then you just get all this great stuff out. Just doesn't work that way. And the same with people's opinions. If you look at just a small amount of incentivization will change the way that the information you get. Think about, it hasn't happened for a while, but there was a thing about Christmas number ones, wasn't there? And it was Rage Against the Machine was number one, one Christmas. Now, it was just because somebody had thought it'd be a good idea and a bit funny for the X Factor for it not being number one for a change, and yes, it was, and it was funny, but you know, that wasn't the most popular song in the UK at that time. And you see it on Twitter polls and things like that. Somebody from somewhere will say, "Oh, I want to know what my followers think of this. You know, should we leave the EU or whatever?" And the people who are against that kind of thing will go, "Oh, here's a lark," and they'll get all of their followers to vote the other way, so the person gets the result they were not hoping for, and then the person can go, "Well, this is just nonsense because they've just spoiled it." But of course, what they were hoping for just to be the other way around, and so that they were looking for their own representative sample, if you know what I mean, to reflect their own views. It's all nonsense, but it's driven by these human behaviours that cannot be necessarily predicted.
But this is Goodhart's law and Campbell's law again, which is that, so actually what you've described there, though, is the way that democracy and general elections work. We think it's some sort of pure sense of where people's views are, but it's not. It's how you're able to be able to influence and manipulate people's views to get them to vote in certain ways. That's the nature of a political system. And there's this idea that it's somehow, you know, the whole concept of the will of the people I find absolutely infuriating because of exactly this point. It's not. It's the way in which people were encouraged to vote through the manipulation of the information that they received and the manipulation of the information they didn't receive over a period of time that got them to be able to vote one way or another, whether that's a general election, a referendum, whatever else. And it's, you know, the political system is about how do you game the electorate to be able to vote one way or another. And the maybe one of the scary things at the moment is that I don't take the view that there is mass influence happening through things like Facebook in the way in which the likes of people who were behind Cambridge Analytica liked to claim before they were found out and then actually ran away from. But I do think that there is something about how political narratives now are being shaped to be able to get people to vote in certain ways and then just ignored once you've got the votes there. And whether that's Trump or whether that's what we're seeing in the UK at the moment or whatever else. And the way in which social channels are enabling that to happen without the control that we've traditionally had around media, I think, is probably a bit scary. Which is a bit of a weird how we've got to that from this, but maybe it's just because the world seems a bit weird at the moment.
It is, it's valid, isn't it? That these memes, like the will of the people kind of meme that says, yes, but it was going to be a terrible thing if the will of the people isn't respected. And as you say, that whole thing is so redundant or bankrupt as a term. But then you had we had Jeremy Hunt on the TV the other day saying, and he was very cheerfully explaining that he'd been to see this factory in Kidderminster that employed 350 people, which would be closed down. But he would quite happily do that because will of the people. And what, I just don't understand which constituency he's talking to there. I don't understand who he's trying to influence. Because
the 160,000 people who will vote for him or for Johnson, that's it. But this is the point, isn't it?
People,
they're doing the job at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. There was the YouGov survey, wasn't there, of Conservative Party members that said that they would all, you know, by 60 to 30 or something, in most of these answers, they would rather see significant damage to the British economy, the destruction of the Conservative Party, the breakup of the United Kingdom, are all preferable
fine
to not doing Brexit.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, isn't it, that actually what you're seeing at the moment is that this in extreme, which is that what you need to do to be elected as the leader of a political party is very different from what you need to be able to do to be able to get elected as a governing government in the UK Parliament. So all the messages that are going out now are very much to that single constituency of the current electorate, and they will have to change their tune totally when it comes to trying to be able to win an election. Which then you get into, well, actually, then probably Johnson is the best person for the job, because if there's anybody who's proven in his duplicity...
Yeah, that's right. He's a proven liar. So, and he's probably our best hope.
Anyway, that's a depressing thought. I thought this was going to be happier because we were doing it in the morning.
We segued away from the subject a little bit, but I think it's all interconnected, isn't it? Because the question is, how do you understand what people think and what they are, what they value, and why they will make certain decisions? And I think the answer is, it's damn complicated.
Absolutely. Anyway, thank you to Jeremy. We'll put a link to Listen and Learn Research on the website at wb40podcast.com. Well, there we go. Another week is recorded, issued, sent out to you, and now listened to. Thank you for listening all the way through. We haven't got a show next week because work commitments and stuff. The work commitments are I'm doing an innovation programme for a couple of days. The and stuff is I'm going up to Cumbria to watch a screening of the film With Nail and I in the grounds of the cottage where much of the film was shot, which means I'm going to be quite late back on Sunday. But I'm quite looking forward to that.
Poor lamb, honestly, these late nights. You can't handle them anymore, can you?
Well, it's not the matter of the late night. It's more the fact that we've got to drive back from Cumbria on Sunday. So it'll just be late as opposed to late night. But how's your week ahead looking?
Busy, yeah, loads of stuff going on. And had a busy and enjoyable week last week, and got another one coming up. So, yeah, lots of just lots of stuff going on. I'm not going anywhere this week. I think I'm my horizons geographically are fairly limited, but just got a lot of the old stuff to do with my new colleagues, which is all very interesting. So, yeah, should be a good one.
Excellent. Good. Well, we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Don't forget, you can find out more about the show at wb40podcast.com. You can also join the WhatsApp group. We haven't made a plug for that for a while. If you want to get in touch with us to get the link to join the WhatsApp group, you can do so on Twitter at wb40podcast, and we will send you a link by direct message. And it's a really good resource. There's lots of people on there. There's lots of mutual support, help, and occasionally quite bizarre jokes. So worth joining.
If you'd like to hear from us on the internet, you can go to wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast. We're on Instagram even, if you can find us there. We're also on all good podcasting outlets. And if you find us and there's a way to leave us a review, we would love it if you would.